Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I'm here today with notable bad influence, Michael Kester. And we're going to do House of a Thousand Corpses and Waco. Let me finish.
I will.
The rules of engagement. Is right. That it?
Yeah, that's it, the rule, right? Not the terms.
The rules of engagement. Waco, the rules of engagement.
Right.
We got an email. Apparently, people really like our political shows.
Yeah.
I was talking to you about this. I was almost ready to abandon the shows that get political because there's no reason for them to be on this podcast. Uh-huh. But people have been telling me they really dig those.
Right.
So whatever, I guess we'll just keep doing them.
Cool.
I saw a bunch of stuff this week. I've been doing like exploitation overdrive. But two things I saw, one, Road Racers, which...
Oh, you actually saw it?
Yeah, you could maybe argue it's exploitation. I don't know. But it's the only Robert Rodriguez film I'd never seen. I'm moving into stuff he like did second unit on at this point. But Road Racers... it's like a made for TV thing. It was Selma Hayek's big introduction to film stuff in the United States. And I dug it. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's definitely Rodriguez, which I was afraid because it's not out on DVD. It was really hard for me to get a hold of.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've been looking for this thing for almost 2 years. It's got like German subtitles or something in it.
Really?
Yeah, it was really weird. And the visual quality, I mean, it looked like it was from YouTube or something. But the fact that it's, you know, here's this guy who made Sin City, which was huge. I mean, all the Spy Kids stuff is really, really popular, makes a lot of money. And one of his films still isn't on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, oh, this is going to be awful. And I actually really enjoyed it. The other thing, so I've talked about this on the intro of a few shows. There are particular genres of film that I don't understand, like why they exist. And I think that if you set out to make a film of this genre, you will just fail like indefinitely.
Indefinitely works.
Does it?
Yeah. So indefinitely and definitely is the same as inflammable and flammable.
One of the genres is teen movies, right? High school movies. And I've been exploring this. I mentioned it before, mostly because of Richard Linklater and Dazed and Confused. But this is a genre of film that I just didn't get why it existed. I don't know like why it's around, and I don't respect it as film. So I was like, well, there's got to be some good in here somewhere. So I've mentioned this before, but I thought 10 Things I Hate About You was going to be, you know, the pinnacle of that. It was going to be the best I got. However, after seeing like tons of these, and they're mostly bad, and, you know, by default, I think the genre just makes them bad. You're dealing with young actors who are either cast by, you know, you cast older actors as young, and you're dealing with these themes that are really simple, and you're dumbing down your film for what you think is a simpler audience who can probably understand your films if they weren't dumbed down for you. I have finally found Mean Girls.
Oh, yeah, dude. Mean Girls.
Oh, you've seen this?
Oh, totally.
Okay. See, now no one... I've put off Mean Girls for a long time because people have told me like, oh, you might actually like that. Ha ha. And people say that about certain movies. Yeah. And I think maybe it's almost a joke just to get me to see these films. But man, did I dig Mean Girls.
Yeah, Mean Girls is awesome.
And you know, another thing that kind of turned me off, it was like Lindsay Lohan and Tina Fey. I'm like,
yeah.
Well, what is this? Mean Girls is something maybe we'll hit up in year two of the show because I feel like it's worthy of its own show. But I'm serious. I really enjoyed it. I thought there was a little, and I don't mean like for a teen movie.
Yeah, no, I know.
I mean like it'll go right up there with other films I have that I just watch because mm-hmm. they're great.
Yeah.
The thing I liked about it most was that the comedy, you know, it didn't take the obvious steps ever. It's like what I wanted Saved to be. You know, I had Saved for a long time before I met you and you were like, Saved, what is this?
Yeah.
And that was the first time anyone questioned me liking Saved. And it Saved's a bad film, but I like wanted it to be good.
It's so
like
bad.
I wanted the concept to work. And Mean Girls is where it works.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. It's point on. I'm not going to do what we can only do on a show like Double Feature.
Well, I'm
going to
do something.
Transfer from...
Yeah.
Mean Girls to House of a Thousand Corpses. Right. You want to talk about chapters?
Well, before I talk about chapters, I want to talk about spoilers.
Yeah, there's going to be spoilers.
Yeah, we're going to spoil something. And the thing we're going to spoil is the chapters.
We're going to spoil House of a Thousand Corpses. If you haven't seen it, see it or skip ahead using the chapters.
There you go.
To the Waco film. If you don't like when we get political on the show, skip the Waco
also,
film.
Also, if you don't know what happened at Waco, which neither of us do,
There's spoilers.
We're going to spoil it. Yeah. Okay. We're going to tell you what happened at Waco.
All right.
So,
but first, House of a Thousand Corpses.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film that I haven't seen.
Yeah.
And this was one of yours, and I've been looking forward to doing this film for a long time. A lot of people are probably tuning into this expecting us to kind of rag on House of a Thousand Corpses.
That's not going
to
happen.
I love House of a Thousand Corpses.
Too.
So that's just to let you know, like, we have some bias here. Yeah. We're both Rob Zombie fans. Yeah. We've seen his other stuff. I kind of saw it. Well, I guess not in reverse order. I mean, I saw Devil's Rejects and then Halloween.
The work print of Halloween.
Yeah, the work print of Halloween and then this. So he's got quite a cast here. The big like star of the show for me here, which who isn't, and this is the same is true of Devil's Rejects.
Oh, totally.
Is Sid Haig.
Oh, really?
Captain Spaulding.
Surprise.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, I'm all about Bill Moseley.
I thought there was a lot more of him in this than Sid Haig. Sid Haig kind of does bookends in this.
Yeah.
He's sort of, you know, the very beginning introduction to the world. And then like, he's kind of in the end too.
Well, speaking of the beginning, I think we should digress and talk about how you spent 20 minutes just watching the DVD menu.
Oh yeah. So this has like one of the longest DVD menus of all time. I mean this, and we're going to talk about this more later into the segment, but Rob Zombie just gets it. And I think his DVD menus show that, you know, here's a guy who like he cares about the whole process. This is a guy who would probably cut his own trailers if he could. Maybe he does.
Yeah.
He just really loves the art form. And that makes me love, you know, like a lot of what we talk about with Rodriguez and why I've seen his whole body of work and why I did the same for Rob Zombie. You can tell that they love what they're doing, that they're really into it. They're, you know, they've seen more movies than probably anyone they know.
Right.
And that makes me want to see their films more.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So Sid Haig has a long, long, long history of making, what, since like the 60s?
Like the 30s. 40s.
Yeah. Since 1810, Sid Haig has been in films.
Right.
But notably, and we will talk about this on the next year of the show too, in both Jackie Brown and, well, in Jackie Brown, that's not what I meant to say, but I'll get to that too. Yeah. In both Foxy Brown and Coffee and Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
As kind of a callback.
He's also in, what was that?
Black Mama, White Mama.
Oh, he's Pulp Fiction. Too. He's in Pulp Fiction.
Is he?
Yeah. He's a bartender.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Huh, that's weird. Oh, yeah. I remember that scene now. All right. Yeah. Yeah, that's him. I didn't even remember that. Yeah, this guy's all over the place and has, you know, a lot of exploitation background, which I think is really cool. As I'm watching a lot of the exploitation stuff, I'm trying to find familiar actors and it's not actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
So good to see him again. You're all about Otis. Tell me about that.
So Bill Moseley is like fucking awesome. And
who we've talked about previously in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Which there's a lot of that in this film too.
Yeah, totally. But Bill Moseley, who plays Otis in this and in The Devil's Rejects, like I love Bill Moseley.
Mm-hmm.
Just like everything about Bill Moseley in this film is really intense. And like, I would say he's the darkest character.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's the darkest character allows for when he like does stuff that's kind of on the lighter end, like it's really funny.
Yeah.
But still scary.
Mm-hmm.
Like perfect example being the one scene where he throws the two bleeding bunny people into the coffin to lower them into the pit and says, "No hanky panky."
Yeah. And you're just like, what do you,
yeah,
that's not what you're supposed to say here. Yeah, for sure. Who else in this film?
This film has Tom Tolles, who plays the Officer Wydell.
Yeah.
Which that character, not the actor, but the character being killed in this film is what actually causes the second film to be made because his younger brother goes and seeks revenge and then it takes a weird, fantastic turn. The Devil's Rejects is like the greatest movie ever made, almost. Then Sherry Moon Zombie, I've seen everything she's been in.
The height of her work being Werewolf Woman of the SS, naturally.
So I've seen everything that Sherry Moon Zombie's been in. On
Wait,
accident.
You've seen all three. Well, good.
Well,
good
she's
for
in
you.
A couple other weird movies that
really?
I didn't realize that she was in. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, exactly. Like I stumbled on him. I didn't know
that's
she was
strange.
In him. She's getting better as her career goes on.
Oh yeah, for sure.
This was her first film.
Yeah.
And she's kind of rocky in it. Really calculated in everything she says. It's like really obvious that like Rob Zombie was like, put an accent here.
Yeah.
Like, and she was like, okay. And then did it exactly that way and didn't play well with the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, fighting effort and she gets better.
I think she's one of the few components of this film that you can really see the improvement from, you know, point A to point Z between the different films. Having watched him kind of out of order too. Yeah. I mean, out of order as far as his filmography goes, right. Rob Zombie's. She's the one performance, definitely, or even just as a component of the film that I can definitively go, well, that was bad here and got better.
Yeah.
I don't think that necessarily hurts her part of this film.
Oh, no, not at all.
If she were better in it, I'm not really sure that that's what it needed. This film does need a little bit of something, and we'll talk about that later too, but I wouldn't pit that on her.
Oh, no, not at all. I think that there are some scenes where she does an especially good job, specifically the Showtime scene.
Yeah.
She did a really good job with that whole scene, like the entirety of it, from the like little routine to when she was going to cut her tits off and shove them down her throat.
Well, and she's got a lot of camp to her, you know, she's really over the top. And
she's a scream queen. Right. That's like, that's really.
And that works here, but wouldn't have worked in something like, say, Halloween.
Right.
Which is why I think that improvement, part of what probably, you know, it was improvement out of both necessity. Mm-hmm. And I think it, you know, it was better lent by the roles.
Yeah.
When the film you're in tends to be a lot more serious than the previous film, you kind of force that performance out of yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if she could have delivered it at this point in her acting career, but almost definitely not.
Yeah, I would say no.
But the fact that the film is just serious right there just puts you in a totally different mindset. Because playing campy, but playing it really well as an actor, that takes a certain level of nuance that I feel like few people could do. I think that's where the transition came in with The Devil's Rejects, is you have a lot of these people like Sid Haig who they're just veterans of their sport.
Sid Haig and Bill Moseley are fucking rock solid in The Devil's Rejects.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
Sherry Moon isn't that bad.
Well, and she's kind of playing a different character.
Right.
And I think that's what, and we're going to avoid spoilers about that film at all when we talk about this. But I think that's kind of where part of the division of those films are. You have these characters who played up a little bit more camp in House of 1,000 Corpses. And they were able to still play the same characters, but do it in a more serious film.
Right.
Whereas you saw with Sherry Moon, she just had to play a different character. Right. You know, if she had played the same character, it would have been so out of place.
It would have stood out really, obviously. Another actor in this film, speaking of careers, you know, morphing, changing, and actors getting better or maybe worse, Rainn Wilson is in this film.
It's really interesting you bring that up. We've mentioned that previously too, but I feel like his career has just died.
Yeah, no, it. I would say
well,
so.
Well, it took off, but I feel like he just, I think because he's given these parts now where he doesn't have to work as hard.
Yeah,
I think
well, that he's, could be he's, it. He's finally hit the Will Ferrell stage it's no longer like him as a role that's interesting. It's like, oh my God, he's wearing a silly shirt.
Yeah, what's Rainn Wilson's new project?
Yeah.
That's just people the Will Ferrell thing was spot on.
Yeah.
And I think you might see that same kind of arc where he does these films that they just, you know, they just hand them to him and he just phones in these performances. And I think eventually there'll be a backlash and maybe he'll have to kind of like man it up and pick better parts.
The thing that's weird about Rainn Wilson's career is this was early on. I want to say it's the first thing he did, but I'm not going to say that. I know that it was definitely the first film he did or one of definitely starring roles, but he was really good in this.
Mm-hmm,
really solid and really natural, which is something that as his career has gone on is like gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I used
it's
to
nuances.
Watch
nuances. You don't get a whole lot.
I
of that
used
anyway.
To watch The Office.
Yeah.
And in seasons one and two, and even into season three, you could watch the naturalness of like his like acting and the reality of his acting fade. And he started just being a character.
Yeah.
Which I mean, that happens when you're in a show like The Office, you become a character. Well, Steve Carell fell victim to the same thing.
Yeah. I want to blame that on screen time. Cause you have that happen a lot of times too. When I look at a smaller part, like 6 feet Under, he had kind of a bit role in the overall content of the show. You know, he was only in it for part of a single season pretty much. And, you know, you didn't get to know him well enough for those kind of subtleties to stop being, you know, sort of the enigma that makes you interested in his character. And so I want to go, well, you know, if he has smaller parts like he did again in this.
Yeah.
But then you see him in something like Juno, which he like, you know, that's not the way you want to set the tone for that film. I think that was the biggest error of the film.
For sure.
And he's in it for literally like 45 seconds.
Yeah, he has like five lines.
Yeah, and, at most. And it's like literally the worst five
and
lines of
like,
dialogue.
And he's like, what's up, honey bear? Got a tizzle vizzle with your Etch-A-Sketch.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Juno's like, hamburger phone.
So you see him mostly in the beginning of the film. And the beginning of this film is, you know, it's got to be the most solid 20 minutes of anything I've seen in a long time.
Oh, totally.
I really love this. you know, until about maybe the middle of the film, I was ready to put this like, I was ready to say this was better than Devil's Rejects for me. And I might still say that. I mean, I love this film. There was a lot of camp here, but I think the film is, you know, it's mostly misunderstood. Well, it's kind of film I think you sort of have to work to enjoy. You have to have to done your research.
Right. Yeah, I think all of the camp in this film and all of the weirdness that people were put off by were homage to, you know, films and definitely films in the 80s and late 70s because of all the Texas Chainsaw stuff.
Yeah, I mentioned this specifically in the beginning because you get this weird kind of feel with the way it's shot that I can't put my finger
where
on.
Where everything is zooming in and out in slow zoom.
Yeah, you have a lot of the slow zoom, which is going back to that kind of 60s thing. Slow zoom isn't always bad. I mean, we've railed against it a lot because it's, you know, it's something that 80s filmmakers still put in their films today and they don't like get that we've stopped wanting to see that. But here it's kind of a callback and it's a pretty subtle callback. It's not like, hey, look at this slow zoom scene. Remember this from that film? And I was worried this film would just be kind of a lot of references to earlier film. It would be like spot the old film this is from. And it's not that. Again, I think it's a lot more subtle than that.
Yeah.
The feel of the film though takes a really weird kind of, it feels kind of like an early 90s, like kind of show that's on FX or sci-fi. It's shot in a lot of kind of stage atmosphere with a lot of that weird sort of TV lighting, like almost like a show you could find on Fox at like a Saturday morning, 11:30 a.m. And I wish I had specific examples in my mind, but it's stuff that I probably haven't seen since I was a kid,
you
know, on TV. But it's like this weird kind of thing where you're flipping through channels and you would notice you have this weird gem of usually a constant TV show, right?
Right.
Something that I always remember like the weird Shannon Doherty stuff on, I think it was the Sci-Fi channel where they do like sort of mock-up things of weird paranormal events or whatever.
You totally lost me.
Really? You've never seen any of that stuff?
Sorry, dude. Sci-Fi channel.
That was like my childhood. Yeah, and it's got that strange feel to it. And that kind of made me feel a lot more invited into the film. It made me want to, you know, it made me want to know the characters. It made me want to know this odd little shop that they found. And I think, you know, I don't know if that was intentional or not. I mean, it could be a matter of, you know, your lucky mix of the kind of equipment that you got to shoot this film and the, you know, the stage you did it with and the lights. It's not necessarily, you know, with Rob Zombie, I want to say it's a choice he made. I mean, this is a guy who's seen what, every film ever made?
Every horror film ever made.
Yeah. So he knows what he's doing. And I want to say it was a choice he made on purpose. But the feeling you get early in this film is it's one that, at least for me, made me want to know what's going on. It made me want to know the characters. It made me want to know the environment. It's weird because you have this kind of like roadside strange place. And they make you want to know about that. They make you want to learn about the place through more of storytelling techniques than like visual eye candy. They don't do a whole lot of the like, hey, look at all the funny stuff in the shop. They do a little bit of it, but it's mostly, you know, it's the conversation that Captain Spaulding and Rainn Wilson's character have early on.
Yeah.
Just kind of about films in general and about the nature of this little shop that they've stumbled into. And I was really, really interested to learn more about this. And that's why I attached myself to this early on. And I was like, I need to know every single last detail about everything that happens in this film. I'm just absolutely in love with it.
Then like after the beginning of the film where it kind of, it has like a, basically it doesn't have a horror feel.
No, it doesn't. I mean, you have your scare shots that are sprinkled through. And I think those are one of the few things in the movie where it was like, hey, scare shots aren't horror films.
Right.
This is a horror film. Look at my scare shots.
So then the film moves on. And once you start like getting kind of, once you start like seeing the family, like when they pick up baby and then RJ fixes the car and they go to the house, I'm guessing you're not as along with the ride at this point, but like that's when it starts getting like I'm really into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the first part a lot, but I'm even more into it when you start getting to know this family, because the way that Rob Zombie does the family, it's really eerie, but like for almost the entirety of the time they're like in the house until they leave after showtime.
Yeah.
They just seem weird.
Yeah.
They don't seem dangerous. They don't seem threatening in any way. They seem highly sexually active and strange.
Right.
And like reclusive.
Well, that's one of the things that I think this capitalized on, because the family thing is almost directly from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? I think there's a pretty direct parallel there. And in some of those films, they get it. And in some films, you know, characters stay with the family for no other reason than it's a Texas Chainsaw Massacre film.
Right.
You know, sometimes they're trapped, or sometimes they're, for whatever reason, there's always some kind of reason, or sometimes there's not.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have people that are with the family, and you kind of take a step back and go, okay, I know it's a Texas Chainsaw movie, but why are they there?
Yeah.
And this film, I think you hit it. They're not dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, so these people are kind of there out of necessity a bit, but they're not running away because they're not terrified. They're just like, why are these people so odd?
And I think the film explains that, like, it sprinkles it and it's really like subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Sid Haig brings it up when he's talking to Rainn Wilson about how, oh, you think we're crazy Southern folk and need to get ourselves some education.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I think, what it's being written off as. Like, they're weird, but it's because they're reclusive, like, country folk.
Yeah, reclusive and Southern.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff we saw in 2001 Maniacs.
Yeah.
That kind of, like, they're wearing this sort of costume of, hey, we're just crazy and Southern, and they know what's up. You know, they're keeping score, and they're just like, well, these people think we're just reclusive and Southern, so we're going to play that
game. So they're, like, really sexually active, and, like, you know, they all have Southern accents, and they have a baby in a jar and a burn victim giant. And
that stuff still works for me.
Oh, totally.
Even to that point, I'm still directly behind this. And that's part of that exploration of wanting to get to know the characters in this a lot more. That still worked for me. I still love that stuff a lot.
And then they don't actually realize that they're dangerous in almost any way. Like, there's this scene where the two girls, like, kind of get into a cat fight, and even that seems natural.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like anything completely out of the ordinary.
Right.
You don't even, like, get this sense of alertness, which is, I think, what they use to, like, so there's this, like, definitive scene where the film takes the turn.
Yeah.
Where they're in the car, and they pull up to the gate, and they stop, and Rainn Wilson's got to get out and open the gate. So if they felt any sense of danger at this point, any sense at all, they would ram the gate.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a gate that he can get out and open, it's not something that's going to, like, hard, fast, and not going to, like, move when a car hits it.
Yeah.
But they're like, well, they're weird. Well, I just got to get out and open the gate. And he gets out, and then the scarecrows jump down, and it's Otis and Tiny, and they beat the shit out of them.
That's where things go violent.
That's the first time that anybody in the film realizes they're actually in, like, a lot of trouble.
So where do you think the film starts to go wrong then?
Well, there's a little thing with the cops and the altercation when things kind of get progressively worse and worse.
Yeah.
And then there's the scene where they start, basically when they start lowering them into the well, that is essentially where I think the film gets lost. And I don't know if it's because so much has been removed from the film.
Yeah.
To get, like, a decent, you know, showable rating.
Yeah.
I know that there's been, like, at least an hour just cut from the film. But I feel like everything underground is weird. It's completely, like, obscure and not explainable.
Yeah.
And rushed.
There's a giant piece of time there that's kind of gone. So this film, I've said this before, but I feel like it's misunderstood. There was a lot of backlash around this film, and kudos to Rob Zombie to, like, continue on a successful career after this. Because here's a guy who's been making music based on films for decades. And finally, you know, he puts a pause on his career to start making films, and everybody's excited about it. All these horror buffs are going to go out and see this stuff. And a lot of them came back and said, well, first of all, it was billed as, like, the goriest thing to ever, you know, undergo a filmmaking process. And when it came to theaters, and I think it's a matter of stuff being cut, it really wasn't gory.
Yeah, not
really.
And
there's a few select scenes that have, you know, very monster makeup gore to them. So I think that's part of the reason it's misunderstood, is a lot of people went in expecting that. For me, this turning point you talk about here, it's where the film, I feel like, it kind of starts losing its head.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, well, where is this really, where's it decided to go? You know, I kind of feel like I missed a little something.
Yeah.
By the time it gets to the end, I've picked back up on that. But there's that whole segment there where it just kind of lost me for about 20 minutes. And that for me doesn't make the film fail. I still think it's fantastic. And I can overlook, you know, that 20 minutes there. Just because I can kind of see, through the filmmaking process, I can kind of see sort of empathizing with Rob Zombie's situation, what he's, you know, put in to make this film. When I said you have to work to enjoy this film, I don't directly mean if you're going to go see this, you should see a bunch of other stuff first.
Yeah.
But this isn't a film that I think is made for, it's made for a really target audience,
yeah.
a really specific audience. Not even just horror fans, but horror fans who've really seen their shit.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is a movie that the more stuff I see, especially older stuff, the more I'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's made by a guy who's an enthusiast. Sherry Moon's a perfect example of this, right? Because Sherry Moon is in this film for literally one reason. It's Rob Zombie's wife.
Yeah.
Like it's not like he went out and found her and what a great actress. So great they got married and now she's in all his films. He's excited to make films and he wants to bring his wife in on the process.
Yeah, well, Bill Moseley's his neighbor.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think that stuff is great. I think it's awesome. You're making films with your wife. She's an enthusiast too. Like you're bringing back, basically you're filming a lot of these scenes that you've seen in, you know, some of your favorite old horror movies, and they're not direct references. They're just kind of techniques and things you wanted to use that finally you got to put in your film. One of the things you mentioned to me after we saw this, is that, you know, Devil's Rejects really didn't rely on a lot of the kind of gimmicks
yeah.
that this film uses. It's got a lot of the old monster movie stuff.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of the like one-off.
Well, it has a lot of the Rob Zombie shots. Music video stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah. Stuff that he's been putting in that for a long time. And I like that stuff here. I think Devil's Rejects is a different film. And a lot of people, I think the reason they like that better is because they like that breed of serious film more.
Yeah.
And I should say, you know, like I'm not an expert on this stuff. When we started doing the show, you go and listen to the old podcast. We started with The Singing Detective. I mean, I didn't know jack shit about horror films.
Yeah.
And I've just been watching a lot of them. And we're on what, show like 33 or something?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we haven't even been doing this a full year. And I'm able to spot a lot of these old references, a lot of the eras of film that this stuff comes from. And I think it just gives me a much greater appreciation of what he did.
Right.
And so he didn't make a film, not even for, you know, not only was this film not made for a mainstream audience, it wasn't even made, I don't feel like, for a mainstream horror audience.
Yeah.
I think this is made for, it's hard to say an underground horror audience because there's so many different kinds.
Yeah. I think it's just a specific camp of horror.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. I think it's that kind of person who grew up on older science fiction a little bit.
Basically, it's a movie Rob Zombie made for himself and anybody that's enough like him to enjoy the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I think
it shows like the whole way through. Like, I think going through the film, I could sit there and see Rob Zombie watching it and like it being his favorite movie.
Yeah, for
like,
sure.
Had he seen it instead of made it, he'd be like, this is the best movie ever
made. Well, and see, I would agree with that, except for this piece that we think fails here. Because I feel like, you know, if you asked him about it, and I should like look into this because I feel like it's got to be stuff that's missing or a disagreement he had with, I don't see him in that. You know, when this stuff gets confused, I mean, it kept its head so well up until that point and everything that all the characters spoke about, it was all definitely building towards something. And there is a definitive point where it's not really a definitive point. It's kind of a hazy point where stuff just starts to unravel and then picks back up with an ending that I feel like would have been, the point it picks back up for me is that kind of underground vertigo shot when she's going into the house, which for me, the thing that kind of like makes this really confusing is you have your lone survival girl now.
Mm-hmm.
And who is this girl? We don't really care about her. She hasn't been the focus of the film. You know, she's kind of one of the girls who's along with your two lead male characters here who have been offed or are otherwise missing at this point. So now we're kind of following this girl as our protagonist who really like we're not behind. Again, I feel like because there's missing stuff there. There's footage that isn't there. So when we get to the end of the movie and Dr. Satan.
Yeah, the big reveal of Dr. Satan falls flat for me.
See, I really like that. I think that has this certain like classic monster movie element to it that I really, really dig. I just feel like I don't know why I'm excited. That's the thing is once I get there, if that was a promo for the film, if that was a poster, like a lot of the Tyrannosaurus Rex kind of stuff, is that like, hey, look at this thing that's going to be in this movie. I would be so into it. I'd be like, oh, that looks great. It reminds me a lot of that Del Toro stuff, that kind of stuff you saw out of Pan's Labyrinth or even the second Hellboy movie where it's like big monsters, big
weird,
kind of makeup
obscure
job.
Creatures.
Yeah, that. And you're like, well, that looks really like visually appealing. It's really interesting. And I felt that way about Dr. Satan and even the father, although a lot less for the father. Dr. Satan's what really intrigued me about the end. So when we got there, I was like, all right, I'm back into this film. This is it for me. From the second she walks through that door, you get the vertigo shot, which I think isn't necessarily like there's anything about the vertigo shot that makes it great. It's mm-hmm. just the placement, like the place that they're in to see that long hallway. And yeah. go, this is a good place for a vertigo shot, yeah. like spot on. And then you get her opening the doors and you get kind of that like almost first person kind of low to the ground shot that uh-huh. just opening the doors. I love everything about that. And you go in and you see all this weird stuff going on in there, but it's so rushed.
Yeah, you know,
I'm back
rushed.
To that point where I'm really excited. I feel like, you know, if I could just make edits right now to fix this, I would cut out all the hazy stuff. And there's a missing reel in the film and you get right to the end.
Yeah.
Because I want to spend more time. Like by the end of this film, even though there was part of it that I felt like was unnecessary or maybe like not everything was there about it, I wanted more, mm-hmm. you know, especially of the end. I want to see more of what's going on in there. I want to know who all those characters are. I want to know what's going on with Dr. Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he made the right choice in that you explore those a little bit in the next film, but that's really all you can do with it,
yeah.
right? Because once the footage is out of there, I really think I'm right about that. I really think there's got to be missing stuff.
Oh, I know there's missing stuff.
Well, I feel like it's that spot. It's like beginning of the third act kind of stuff. It's got to be where it goes. Another thing I love about this movie too is a lot of the bit parts. You have the guy in the liquor store, mm-hmm. the Red Hot Pussy liquor store, which
Goober.
Has that great great Rob Zombie track in it. A lot of the music stuff in this, I mean, I think that kind of goes without saying, we're fans of Rob Zombie, fans of the music in here too. Even a lot of the classical kind of, I'd say classical, but like classic rock kind of selections he made for this really went along with, you know that this guy knows his stuff. You know he's picking out stuff from different eras. And I think a lot of it showed that. But even a lot of those kind of bit parts, little characters, I mean, I liked all of that stuff about it. Well, the only thing I really knew about this going into it was the one scene you've described previously.
About 100 times in the 33 shows.
Yeah. Which is the single scare shot that always gets you.
Yeah. The only scare shot that ever consistently gets me in film.
Because part of the mechanic of a scare shot is just that you don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
But this is one that's pretty obviously coming.
A really good example of a scare shot that got me once but never again
mm-hmm.
was when I watched Hatchet. I watched it alone in the dark by myself.
Right.
In an empty apartment.
Yeah.
So whenever Victor Crowley jumped out, it scared me.
Yeah.
But then when I watched it a second time, I'm like, and now. And then he would jump out. So this is like the alternate theory behind a scare shot, which is they feed it to you. They're like, get ready, it's going to come. And it's not like the kind of, you know, it's going to happen, like things get silent and you wait for it. It's more like Otis holds a gun up to this cop's head.
Right.
And the camera just pans back and it's silent. It's been playing a song and the song ends and it's just silent and it pans back and you wait for the fucking gunshot. And it's probably 35, maybe 45 seconds.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that only if you knew like exactly where it was coming timing-wise,
well,
maybe
you'd have to count it yourself.
Yeah, for sure. It's taking the exact opposite of the construction of a normal scare shot.
Yeah.
This is, again, to go back to what I mean about a filmmaker that knows his stuff. This is a guy who's seen hundreds and hundreds of these movies, thousands of these movies. And he knows how to execute a scare shot. And he said, well, I'm going to do something different. If Rob Zombie will be known in 50 years in cinema for doing anything, it'll be for the way he deconstructed and then reconstructed previous principles like this. Something that is the oldest mechanic in the book and what I feel is like one of the lamest and needs to be dealt away with in all of horror is the scare shot. You know, we've been talking about it since day one of this show. And this is something that it takes almost the reversal and it makes it really effective. I knew this was coming. You told me it was coming. Yeah. And I think anyone with half a mind kind of knows it's coming. You don't get the music cue, right? You, in fact, it even takes that away because it's been playing a pretty upbeat song, right? And then you just cut to silence. There's no tension built up before this, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, with the exception of the scene itself. It's not like where we talk in Hostel about how the movie is so tense or The Descent is like that too. Where they could make a scare shot out of someone sneezing because you're just so you're in the cave and you're like, oh my God, that you feel pretty loose. Things are going on. You're having a good time. You probably have a smile on your face. You're watching this film and the camera isn't, you know, the other scare shot thing is when you cut in really close with the camera, you change the scene or you, you make a fast edit and there's stuff like that in this film, but this particular shot it gives you the least scariest possible position.
You're not even near the character and you're in the sky.
It's farther out than a wideout shot. I mean, you're like, you're way back, you're up. No one's going to look at you. Nothing's going to run across. You're in the sky.
Yeah.
Nothing can fuck with you up here. You're in a tree watching this. And they make no cuts about it. There's nothing flashy that happens on the screen. There's no, like, there's no cheap editing technique. I mean, it's straight, like, there's no magic to this.
Yeah.
It's straight out just basic, like, human feeling to it. And I love that that's what makes it work. And you jumped, like, off the couch.
Yeah.
Like, you visibly jumped up like a cartoon character. And I was pissed because I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to watch the scene and it's not going to. And I don't, man, it's so stripped down is what gets me. There's two elements. You're looking at basically a picture and you get a loud sound. And I mean, how do you avoid that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's techniques when you're watching a horror movie, you can keep one eye closed. You can kind of pay attention to a different corner of the screen. You can try and tune out the score.
Uh-huh.
You can make the scare shots not work if you don't want to be scared. But this is like, if you have ears and eyes, then it's going to get you.
Yeah.
And it's going to get you every time.
It's awful. I mean, it's fantastic, but it's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Yeah. What it does. It's terrible because it works and you're like, God damn it.
Yeah.
But man, I think if there's like, if I just wanted to show any technical film proficient person a shot that I think makes this movie really shine, this would be the one here.
Totally.
So yeah, that's how I feel about this film. I think it's really misunderstood and I think people need to give this another chance.
Yeah, for sure.
Fans of the genres, I think, will really enjoy it too.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna say something that everyone you know has probably told you the opposite of. You should see this before you see Devil's Rejects.
Yeah, you should.
Because Devil's Rejects is one of the only films where I've seen the sequel before the original, because everyone told me you don't need to see House of a Thousand Corpses. It's pretty much not a sequel at all. And no, it is, you guys. It really is. It's got the same characters. You're dealing with the aftermath of the same story. Visually, it's a more serious film. It's a different kind of feeling. You know, you get that very end scene of this where you crawl out from underground and the movie kind of goes from campy monster film to like 60s dust film, kind of that vanishing point kind of feel to it. And that sort of, you lead into Devil's Rejects like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably an intentional choice that he had already made, you know, at that, by the time he was finishing up House of a Thousand Corpses, to kind of set the tone of the other film. So different tones, but they really are sequels.
Yeah, for
sure. True as any sequel has ever been a sequel to another film before. Mm-hmm.
So I guess we shift from a grossly large fictional body count to a grossly large
factual body count. Yeah. How do you like the double feature with themes? It's better.
It's way better.
Okay.
Even if the theme is body count, which is my favorite theme, even though it has a little bit too much iced tea.
All right. So Waco's a film that I wanted to do because I think Waco is still relevant. And as me, you, and
everyone we know.
Yeah. Watched this film today. No one knew anything about Waco.
Mm-hmm.
I still, after like my third time, still feel like I don't know anything. And I've read interviews and like, so this film, I have to credit again to my Attic Expeditions ex-girlfriend for getting me to watch. And I don't think me and her talked about it. No one has any idea. The problem is it's like 2008, 2009. What year is it? And Waco was 1993. This film was 97. So at least the film had some reflective time, but it was really fucking long ago is my point. And I think it's still culturally relevant, especially recently, because now we're busting all these cults everywhere. You know, we have all these like polygamous factions and all this
religiosity.
Thank you. And it's so, I don't know. I feel like it's still relevant. And plus we have, you know, this idea that, hey, the government kind of fucked up. And whether or not that's true, that's what I kind of want to explore on the show today. From a filmmaking standpoint, though, we suffer from
the film.
Well, the film being so old.
Yeah.
The film came out in a time where people knew what Waco was. And if you saw this film in the 90s, maybe that's great. But, you know, we're in the 21st century now. We need a recap.
Mm-hmm.
That's something we've taken for granted in a lot of the documentaries we've watched, is that they're fairly recent events, subject matter, or that they give a better kind of narrative. This film, just you jump right in as if you already, you know, as if this is a sequel, right?
Right.
Which oddly enough, this film has a sequel, but this isn't it.
Right. Well, it's so a sequel to Waco.
You don't get any of the key players. So no one has any idea what's going on. So in case the person listening to this podcast has no idea what happened at Waco, you have your two camps, right? Your two, we're going to boil this down into two parties here. We have basically the government, we'll just call it, right? The ATF and then later on the FBI. And then we have the Branch Davidians, how would you summarize the Branch Davidians?
They're a super cult of Protestants. It's a radical division of a very radical division of Protestantism.
All right, that sounds about right. The word cult is thrown around, and I don't like using the word cult at all. You get into this a lot, and we'll talk about it when we hit a Scientology film. But neither of us are big fans of religion, and determining when you're at religion and when you're at cult, like, that's a whole gray area.
Yeah, for me
to discuss right there. Yeah. So, I mean, they're really religious and they have strange ideas.
I think the line is drawn somewhere between, like, when you have too few people and you live in the same place.
Right. In a giant commune.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, all right, we'll call them a cult. And there's sort of two opinions of what went down.
Mm-hmm.
There's this idea, there's the idea of backing each side, backing the government and sort of more sympathizing with the Branch Davidians. And somewhere in between that is the truth, which is ridiculously hard.
Joe Biden seems to think that Waco situation was inflamed by the Branch Davidians.
Literally, that they committed suicide, which seems to be the official story of what happened, or at least at the time.
I don't know about the official story, but it seems to be the...
From what I've read, like, that seems to be the story that people put out.
Okay.
I mean, that's kind of why they had the investigation. It's similar to the 9/11 commission. You know, we had basically what popular culture deemed as well, you know, the media as well as the government as the official story. And then later we kind of reopened it and kind of went, hey, we need more information about what happened. And I think that, you know, that panel that we saw in the film was probably just as unhelpful as the 9/11 commission was. So I go into this film with a lot of skepticism. Because of Loose Change, mostly. Because I saw Loose Change a couple of years ago, which is the 9/11 conspiracy film.
I've still never seen it.
We'll cover it on the show. It's, you know, I came away from it going, well, I know, like, I don't want to say I know in my gut, because that's not a good place to know things. But I have this feeling that 9/11 can't really be a conspiracy. But the film really makes you feel like it is. And you're just going along with the narrative. And it turns out 9/11 not a conspiracy, as we'll talk about. But it was easier to find my facts on that because, you know, we've had the internet since 2001. Right. Well, since before that, but you know what I mean? In 93, the internet was not big. People weren't writing blogs. If you do searches for Waco on the internet, it's a lot harder to come up with information than it is 9/11 conspiracies. The other thing, just really quick from a filmmaking perspective here, and I know you pointed this out too, is that there's no real narrative structure.
Yeah, there's like one point of narration and the rest of the film is like,
we
lost.
Don't know who the guy narrating is, right? We don't really see him. We don't know. You know, we've really spoken out against Michael Moore. That style of filmmaking, you know who your narrator is. You see the guy on camera. And that's why I think the Michael Moore thing's a little more transparent. Well, you know, you know who that guy is and you know, even through his deceptive tactics that you disagree with him. When we looked at this film is not yet rated.
Yeah.
You know, here's a film that stars its filmmaker. I mean, you know exactly what you're dealing with there. And I think this is, again, a classic example of why I prefer that type of documentary over this one. This one, you kind of get lost. You don't really know, you know, it's hard to figure out who's talking to you about what, you know, and if you can believe them. When you have a face to associate with the voice or even a voice in the first place, because you don't really get that in this, you kind of know your narrator.
Right.
And you know whether to buy into their story or not.
Well, but I would say that the execution was done really well with Jesus Camp. That didn't have, I mean, it didn't really have any narration at all.
That's true, but there isn't a whole lot of controversy there.
Yeah, I was going to say the thing about Jesus Camp is...
There's controversy, but it's pretty black and white what's going on. And it's just, you know, the
black
controversy
and white, not
is
infrared.
The controversy is how you feel about that subject, you know. But you're right, Jesus Camp is a much better example of that. Something this documentary did, though, that I think really holds it together, even, you know, over the years since it's been made, is that it dwelled on facts rather than emotions.
Yeah, completely.
You start to get some of the family members towards the end.
Yeah.
But even that, it's not, you know, once in a while they'll throw something out just to remind you of how like horrific this is. When the drummer talks about the loudest sound he's ever heard being the fireball. Or, you know, you talk about a lot of the families, you see grieving families, but the film doesn't get too held up in emotion. I mean, the point isn't to go like, look what a tragedy this is. It's to get to the bottom of what happened there. It's to be evidence-based. And the fact that the film is well over 2 hours, not well over 2 hours, but we watched the 165-minute cut here.
Yeah.
135-minute cut,
35.
Sorry. There's also a 165-minute cut that's really hard to get a hold of that the producer released and was pulled in a 95-minute. You don't really have time for emotions in, you know, a cut that's this long. You obviously you have a lot of facts to get out there and emotions, I think, would have just, you know... gummed it up, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term. The film also wasn't afraid to show some corpses, which it kind of, you know, picture worth a thousand words. I mean,
yeah.
Seriously, you don't need to have sob stories of grieving families when you have a corpse bent, you know, over backwards through convulsions of the bone. I mean,
yeah,
that pretty much says all you need right there.
Yeah,
and some pretty, you know, stomach turning pictures.
Yeah.
I mean, some stuff that's pretty bothersome. Human corpses torched alive. Not
a big fan of that.
Not so much. No.
Well, we all have our things.
All right. So give me the lowdown. What happened here? What's the story?
Okay. So the version of the story that has no bias is that there were a group of religious, you know, people that lived in a compound in Waco, Texas.
All right.
And the government had reason to believe that they had, what's it called?
It's a hellfire device, hellfire trigger. Basically, it allows you to fire a semi-automatic weapon, like a handgun. You know, semi-automatic being where the gun reloads each time you pull the trigger and it's ready for another round. It allows you to fire it fully automatically. You know, like most people, when you hear automatic, think where you hold down a trigger and it just fires over and over and over.
Yeah.
So that's what led them to the compound.
So the ATF is the first government agency to respond to figure out what's going on with these firearms. And, you know, in a nutshell, there's firing, and I personally believe it was the ATF's fault first.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it sounds like that's where things kind of fell.
Again, this is where I fall into that loose change territory where this is really the, I mean, film-wise, this is the only evidence I have.
Yeah.
You know, I've tried to do reading about it. I've read the interviews. And again, it's so far distant, it's hard to pick apart the truth. But if we had to make a call here and now, I would say, that's probably what went down.
So there's an altercation, to say the least, where the ATF eventually has to back out because they ran out of ammunition.
Sure. The big evidence piece there that's referred to over and over is the door, right? That you have all these entry, you have bullets that, you know, the ballistics make it look as if the bullets came through the front door and into the house.
Right.
You have strong evidence that, you know, the ATF has been firing on them. And you also have the big, you know, the big holdout with the speakers and the psychological warfare. Now, when you get to that panel, when you get to that council there, they say none of this existed. You see constantly, you know, the people from the government lying, which is something great you can do in a film from 97, is pull out these pieces of information where people went, that didn't happen, but it's 1997 and that's already come out that that definitely happened.
Yeah.
Like we weren't using psychological warfare, and then they cut directly to showing footage, you know, with sounds of like animal sounds and, you know, these giant bright light, pretty like horrifying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty awful.
So essentially the ATF backs out and the FBI goes in to kind of clean up the job. And then things kind of get cloudy. There's basically a standoff where God tells them not to leave the compound.
Right.
And the FBI,
I thought that was weird coming. So you have, David Koresh, who I think could get his own biopic.
No, totally.
I think the guy is like, he's kind of nutty, and he's an interesting, if you want to look at him as a cult leader, because this is a guy who doesn't like to be called the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks God's speaking to him. But I mean, he's not that different from major leaders of major accepted religions.
Yeah, right.
He thinks he's just a vessel. You know, it's like kind of the Ted Haggard thing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who speaks to a massive audience. He's polygamous, which is weird to the American public, right? But outside of that and living with everybody, he seems pretty normal. And as our psychologist friend pointed out when we were watching this, a lot of the things he does that aren't normal, you know, sort of trademarks of a cult leader. I mean, that could be sort of a guise, right?
Yeah.
It could be the kind of thing where he doesn't let people call him the Messiah because that's what cult leaders do. And he doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to be looked at as a cult leader. So you don't know what level of deception you're kind of on there. But I still think that makes him interesting to look at.
Right. And so essentially the way Waco goes is the government gases the building.
Sure.
There's no gray there. The government kind of seems to have admitted to have gassed the building to incapacitate the religious nuts.
Yeah.
After that, there's a fire. The compound burns down. And most of the controversy lies in whether or not the government intentionally started the fire and whether or not the government fired at the compound.
So there's, and you know, there's a lot of points that, and I think this is one of the reasons the film is so long. And if you wanted to cut it down, things you need to get rid of is, you know, you have these kind of petty squabbles like, You know, like they talk about the flashbang thing with the ATF.
Yeah.
Whether or not flashbang grenades are grenades, which, you know, if they can blow someone's hand off, yeah, that's a grenade. If you're causing, that's where I come down on this stuff, man. If you're causing physical violence, if you're injuring another person, that's like the moral line where it's no longer okay. But you have them spreading this CS agent, which just causes the compound to be a giant tinderbox, and it ignites fairly easily.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the piece of controversy around this is whether or not the Branch Davidians killed themselves, which doesn't seem to be in line with things David Koresh has said. You know, he seems to be really against suicide. He uses the literalist biblical translation right. of the Bible. You know, you commit suicide, you don't go to heaven. So it doesn't really seem to make sense. However, I'm always trying to think motivation here when I'm trying to skeptically get to the bottom of something that's going on using only evidence that I don't know the bias of. Again, right. if I knew my bias here, this would be a lot easier. I'm trying to think what's the motivation of the FBI to just light the compound on, because that's not how the law works, right? In case you're an international listener, in America, we try criminals.
Right.
So if you're guilty of hoarding weapons or maybe molesting children, we will try you in a court of law and then determine your punishment. We don't go in and just burn down your house and kill you,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't like mutilate you with tanks.
So come on over to America.
What do you think the motivation is?
Well,
for the FBI then?
I think
if they were to be the ones that burned down
the
compound.
Well, I'm going
to
go ahead and say that that's where I stand. I think that, and just again, with the documentary being the evidence,
sure.
with the infrared video, it falls.
Well, yeah, you have that FLIR stuff, which is really hard for me because mm-hmm. they're presenting this FLIR evidence, this infrared heat evidence, which, you know, you have basically their word on the interpretation of this panel that evaluated it. So you're not reading it, the report yourself. You're, you know, hearing what they cherry picked out of it. And then also you have their token expert who is pointing at the screen and right. saying, this is what this means. We don't actually know anything about this technology. I mean, this is, I compared it to ghost photos, right?
Yeah.
You have this thing in infamous ghost photos where you have ghost orbs. Right. And it's just like bad photography. It's flash reflecting off metal objects.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Now, to the untrained eye or someone who knows nothing about photography, you go, well, what is that? This guy says it's a ghost orb. Okay. I'm not saying the FLIR guy is lying. I probably buy his story. But that's another thing that kind of makes the red flag go up is mm-hmm. you go, well, I don't know anything about this technology. So when I'm taking this evidence in, I guess I just got to buy the story.
Right. The motivation that I could see for the FBI to, you know, actually go in and set fire to the compound.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it would have to do with what happened with the ATF.
Yeah.
Where the ATF goes in and kind of basically fails and like embarrassingly so.
Yeah, sure.
Against basically a peaceful religious group.
Yeah, a hippie commune.
Yeah, and they fail.
Like
they fail in a military tactic against a hippie commune.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what they see it as.
Yeah.
So I think the FBI goes in there and they're kind of, you know, angry and they feel cheated and they're like, we're going to show these fuckers. And then furthermore,
they
there's
almost
been
want
all
revenge.
Yeah, there's been all the press coverage on David Koresh, like,
right.
you know, and once it comes out that somebody molests children, regardless of whether or not they do.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks they
guilt
do.
Guilt isn't the question. Yeah. It's the severity of the yeah. crime. Sure. One of the great flaws of this wonderful American legal
yeah.
system.
Not to bring up an example that's like completely unrelated, but when Paul Rubens, like, got arrested for indecent exposure in a theater
mm-hmm.
and like someone misquoted or like maybe blew it out of proportion and said like he molested children, like that ruined his career.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Completely.
Immediately.
Because you have a child.
You're tried in the public court. You know?
Yeah. So I personally don't believe David Koresh had anything to do with child molestation, but it came up in court. And so officially everybody believed it immediately.
So you're saying it became this thing you think that was part of the reason it was like, we have to go in there and get this guy.
Yeah. But right. then I can't really say that's entirely justified because they kill all the kids too.
Yeah, the women and children thing. I mean, that's it's pretty awful. I don't think, you know, suffering of any human life is okay. I think women and children, like that idea comes from a really kind of old mindset that
where women need to repopulate the planet and children are the population.
Right, and big strong men can fend for themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, I think obliterating any human life there that day was probably a bad idea. I think that's where I come down with the story too. I think, you know, again, it's really hard and you have to be really skeptical of all these claims that are being made, but that seems to be, you know, from what I've read, that seems to be the best way that to put together this story. The only alternative to me just to look at our possible solutions for this is that they killed themselves. And I can't see that.
It doesn't make any sense.
No, it really doesn't.
I mean, I suppose the third argument is that it just, you know, accidentally a fire started.
Yeah.
But just judging by the, again, what they said about the FLIR video and how there were two injections of the gas in the two places where the fire started right before the fire started, leads me to believe that it almost couldn't been accidental.
Yeah, right.
It could have been intentional on the part of the Davidians. Like, I don't believe it, but
right.
I don't believe that there's a possibility for a coincidence of both of the two injection points to have caught fire.
Sure. Well, and at the point where they're showing all of the tanks poking holes,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that the gusts of winds will create fireballs. That's the point to me where it looks like strategy.
Yeah.
And so the big thing to take away from this and the way that I've evaluated this film is that you have to be really, anytime I hear conspiracy theory, I get really, really skeptical, right? Because conspiracy theories exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you look at Nixon, like that was a conspiracy and it did happen.
Yeah.
But what always jumps to my mind is moon landing conspiracy, which is silly.
Yeah.
9/11 conspiracy, which is, and Kennedy, right? The three big American conspiracies, which it turns out the official story is actually probably what happened mm-hmm. in most of those cases, if not definitively in all of those cases.
Right. We just lost like 10 listeners.
So, well, that's fine. I don't really want them listening.
You don't
anyways.
Want conspiracy theorists listening to our podcast.
But here,
I really hope something comes out that we like cause Waco.
Oh no. Yeah. Right. Or we're anti-Semitic. That's what happens anytime you say conspiracies are wrong.
Or you're a child molester and I'm an anti-Semitic person.
Yeah. That's
who hates
fine.
People over 90.
So once things in this movie start becoming a little too convenient, like with the FBI and how they set things up, it starts to sound conspiracy theory-esque to me. And that's what makes me skeptical of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you can paint a lot of situations as a conspiracy. Look at the official story of 9/11. We'll talk about this more on the loose change thing, but a bunch of religious fanatics get together to fly planes into buildings. I mean, that's a pretty big conspiracy.
Right.
You know? Like that in and of itself is what you would consider a conspiracy. When we talk about 9/11 conspiracy theory, we talk about the fictitious idea that the government set it up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the government set up Waco. I don't know if they went in there that day with I feel like they either went in there that day and they decided today we're going to light this place on fire and burn it to the ground, or they went in there and, like often happens with government bureaucracy, there's too much overhead. There's too many people in charge of people who aren't communicating properly.
Yeah.
There's too much lies in chain of command. And something just got fucked up.
Yeah.
And due to bumbling government bureaucracy, bloated government bureaucracy, you have the tragedy that happened that day. What are we doing next time?
Next time. Okay. So next time, and in continuing with our double features with themes. Next time we're going to cover Magnolia of your collection.
Yes.
And aptly, Kinky Boots of my collection.
Which we've considered both to be artsy films.
Yeah.
That seems like enough of a theme to me. As long as the films feel like they go together, we're doing the best we can with this last round of films. And I think for the most part, we've got it. Magnolia is, it's 3 hours long. It's a pretty hefty film. It's by the guy who did Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson. And I think it's kind of a strange film, which, you know, there's a lot of things about it I like. It falls into Eyes Wide Shut territory for me, where it's been a while since I've seen it. I don't see it often. And I'm wondering if it's good or if there's just a great collection of scenes from it I really like.
Yeah.
I will say that Tom Cruise's best performance, hands down. I love Tom Cruise in that movie, which is an uncomfortable place for me to ever be.
That's fair.
Do you have a film that you're...
Kinky Boots is a movie about boots that are kinky.
Until then, if you know what happened at Waco, if we didn't solve that for you, send us an email. You can do that on our website. It's doublefeatureshow.com. I've been using Last.fm a lot. I kind of love Last.fm. So, you know, use that. We're on there. We also have a MySpace and a Facebook, which our fans go on and talk, I guess.
No, they don't.
Messages. Some of them do. There's
I go on there under people's names and say, hey, you guys are doing a good job.
I was wondering why they always agree
really
with
like,
you.
I really like your Walmart documentary.
And so send us all that stuff. Anything else we need to do?
No. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.